number of years ago, it used to be my pleasure as well as my task to work with a group of young people in forensics. And occasionally we would go on competitive trips. And these young people would engage in debate contest and oral interpretation contest and original oratory contest with students from other schools. On one of those occasions, this was several years ago, there was a young man from another school, and that particular school prided itself on high academics. As a matter of fact, they appealed only to those in the top 2% of the graduating classes in the nation. And there was a young man in that group who made a speech in the contest on original oratory that my young men heard and came back and told me about it. And then I, of course, they called attention to this young man who had given it. And I'll probably prejudice you, and it's obvious that I'm prejudiced by it. But he was dressed in a scrungy pair of blue jeans, had on a pair of thong sandals, had a dress shirt on that looked like it had come right out of somebody's rag bag. It was unbuttoned down about 4 buttons. His hair looked like it had been combed with a weed eater. And he had on a pair of big old metal-rimmed round glasses like Grandma and Grandpa used to wear. But the interesting thing is that in the course of his speech, his oration, he alluded to Jesus Christ. And not in complimentary way. And he had a line that he had written and used in his speech, descriptive of Jesus as he hung on the cross. I didn't hear the speech. The young men told me about it. I identified the boy, and I've never forgotten the line. Because in the speech, he had some of the Jews come along and look up and looked at him and said, "Hey, Naz, what you doing up on that cross? You look all hung up." I think I can imagine how you feel about that line. And you know how I feel. And my thoughts and yours go immediately with Paul to 1 Corinthians 1, when in verses 17 and 18 he makes reference twice to the cross of Christ. That once that God saw fit through the foolishness of preaching to save them that believe. For unto them the preaching of the cross is the wisdom of God, but to such as perish, foolishness. Is it any wonder that Paul is going to conclude in Galatians 6 and 14, "Far be it from me to glory," and that word means to feel good, to exalt in, "far be it from me to glory, save in the cross of Jesus Christ my Lord." I think one of the most glorious songs that was ever written was that beautiful song that says, "In the cross of Christ I glory." I want to talk with you for a few minutes today, and the Lord willing, throughout the week, about the cross of Jesus Christ. What it means to us, what the implications are of the saving blood of Jesus Christ, and our responsibility in our handling of Jesus of Nazareth. It's an absolute delight to be back with you. I was here, I think it was 3 years ago, enjoyed one of the happier weeks of my life, and I'm looking forward to the same kind of thing today. It was such a pleasant time then, and it is going to be now, because I get to do something that I like to do, I guess, above everything, and that is to speak about the Word of God. You know, just put a preacher in the pulpit and tell him, go, man, go. And there's a certain amount of just absolute pleasure with that. And then you add to that, number one, by a lot of the kindnesses that you showed to me then and have already indicated to me since I've been here, the pleasantness of association with brethren. But you added to it even more by the careful attention that you gave, and by the fact that you brought your neighbors and friends, and that you were encouraging to me as a speaker to talk about the things of God. It's a delight to be back, to stay again in the Hunter's home. They're so gracious and hospitable people, and you know that as well as I do, but I want to thank them already in advance for their kindnesses. And to be with the Walkers. I have known the Walkers for some period of time now, but this is my first occasion to work with them in a gospel meeting like this. And I bring special greetings to them and to all of you, from Tony and also from Mike Trokey, both of whom I saw just Friday night and mentioned again that I would be here and we'd talked about it. I even offered to do something for Tony. I offered to, you know, do laundry service. I told her I couldn't give her one day service, but I promised 1 week service if she wanted to bring her clothes, and I'd haul them out here to her mama and let her mother take care of them, and I'd take them back next week and deliver them by hand. And to her credit and to her mother's great relief, she said, no, that's all right, I'll take care of it. But it is a delight to be here, and I'm looking forward to the week with you. There are a lot of things to be said about the cross of Christ. And there are a lot of topics that automatically come into focus when we discuss the cross. I hope that our introductory approach this morning is of value to you. It has come to be of great value to me. I was sitting in an audience listening to another man speak, when he said some things that triggered my thinking along this line. And I want to share these thoughts with you today. Hopefully, it'll be of advantage to all of us. When you think of the cross of Christ, obviously there are many things that are involved with it, but nothing more directly involved than the people who seized him, nailed him to that cross, and took from him his physical life. Now, you and I know that it was all a part of the plan of God, and that that had to be accomplished in order for the forgiveness of sins to be preached and to be enjoyed. But when you think about those people who were involved in it, one name stands out boldly and with a lot of respects, sorrowfully. And that was the man Pontius Pilate, the governor of the land of Judea. All of us are acquainted, I'm sure, with the name of Pilate. Pilate, as I say, was one of the governors that ruled in the land of Palestine. If you remember your history at all, Palestine is shaped something like that. When the Romans came into Palestine about AD 63, they conquered the land and then put in order the same system of government that they used commonly throughout the empire. The Romans tried not to have to take care of daily activities of a local government, so they set someone up from the local area to govern that area. And that person was responsible to keep the peace. Remember, Roman peace, that was a major thought. And to collect the taxes and keep those taxes going back to the governor. And as long as those things were accomplished, the Romans' attitude was, let them govern themselves. Now, the Roman army had been befriended by a man from Idumea. Idumea is the area immediately south of the Dead Sea. And it's the old Edom, and the Idumeans were kinfolks to the Jews, not directly. But the Idumeans included a man named Antipater, who befriended him, who was a friend to the Romans as they came in, and he was a political power. And later, through him, the governorship was set up in Palestine. that we came to know and we know today as the Herods. And there was Herod the Great, and Herod the Great ruled all of this land of Palestine, the whole territory around here. But after he died, the territory was divided among four of his descendants. Now the Greek word for four is tetras, and the word for ruler is archos, or ark. And so we get a word that occurs in our Bible called tetrarch. Now a tetrarch is one of four rulers. And a tetrarchy is a rulership among four. This general area was divided among four of Herod's descendants. Now each of them was called a Herod. There are a lot of these guys that wore the name Herod. Just like there were a lot of people who ended up with Caesar's name being called a Caesar. Well, there were a lot of people who were named as the Herods. And the territory was divided among four of them. One had the southern area, which was homeland to the Jews, Judea and Samaria. Another had Galilee and Perea just across to the east. Another had the land out east, that was Philip. And then another had a smaller section up to the north that included a town or province of Abilene. So there were four of these Herods who were ruling. When Jesus was born, there was a Herod named Archelaus who was ruling in the southern part and had Jerusalem and Bethlehem. That was the Herod who tried to put the babies to death. That was the Herod who was so terrible that when he died, he knew there would be rejoicing in the streets. So he passed a law that when he died, the leaders of the Jews would all be massacred so that there would be mourning in the streets rather than everybody thinking it's 4th of July and running up and down the streets in joy. When that Herod died, there was such a strong resentment to the Herods that the Romans didn't appoint another Herod in that territory. They brought in a Roman governor. Now, can't you imagine who would be named? It wouldn't be the Caesar's own cousin. Because this was an insignificant little territory down there on the eastern Mediterranean. And who's going to be down there? Well, somebody that had a buddy who had a buddy who had a buddy would have a son, and they'd send him down there to kind of learn the Roman system down there in Palestine. Pilate was one of those men. I don't know that he was a youngster. But Pilate was the 10th Roman governor after that Herod's death to rule down there in the southern part. Now, while Pilate was ruling down here in the south, there was still a Herod ruling up in the north. And that's the Herod who's going to be present during the time of Jesus' trial. That's the Herod to whom Pilate is going to send Jesus. Now, Pilate actually set up his headquarters over here at Caesarea. But at the time of Jesus' crucifixion, it was a national feast day among the Jews, the Passover. So Pilate had come down because this is going to be a big time in Jerusalem. All of the notables will be there. It had political advantage, and it also had the danger that some insurrection might come. So the governor needed to be there. It was also the occasion that the Jews from all over the area came for the Passover. So the governor from up in the north, who is known as a king, still wearing the name Herod. And that's the reason you've got one fellow called a king and another one called a governor. They were equals, actually, among the Romans. But they wore their appropriate titles. And Herod, Antipas, was there in Jerusalem at the time of Jesus' trial. Do you remember the occasion? The Jews had become so upset that they finally moved to destroy Jesus. There's an interesting statement in Matthew, the 26th chapter. You remember Matthew 24 and 25, Jesus is preaching publicly, particularly in 25, and warning about the end of the world. Matthew 24 probably is talking about the destruction of Jerusalem. But Matthew 25, the end of the world. And the Bible says in Matthew 26, it came to pass when Jesus had finished all these words, he said to his disciples, "You know that after 2 days the Passover cometh, and the Son of Man is delivered up to be crucified." Verse 3 and 4 give us a commentary, or in 5. "Then were gathered together the chief priest and the elders of the people unto the court of the high priest, who was called Caiaphas. And they took counsel together that they might take Jesus by subtlety and kill him. But they said, not during the feast, lest a tumult arise among the people." Now the feast went on for several days. And they said, we'd probably better not do it now because of all the problems that would come. It's too public now. But drop down to verse 14. "Then one of the 12, called Judas Iscariot, went unto the chief priest and said, what are ye willing to give me? And I will deliver him unto you. And they weighed unto him 30 pieces of silver. And from that time he sought opportunity to deliver him unto them." Apparently they got a shock. And a welcome one when one of his own came and said, I'll do the job, I'll identify him, I'll deliver him. And so they moved even at the time of the Passover, even while the big crowd is there. And the way Jesus had predicted, they moved for his death. They seized him in the garden. And it was the leaders of the Jews who sent to him men with sticks and staves, armed men. The Jewish council had rights. The Jewish council governed the province under the guidance of Pilate. And as long as they maintained peace and harmony and everything went along smoothly, that was fine. Let them govern it. But they had restrictions. They couldn't call for death. And they wanted Jesus killed. They seized him during the night, and if you recall, they took him to the house of the high priest, and they tried him. And the council decided he's worthy of death. So early the next morning, according to Matthew 27, they took him to the governor, Pilate. And we go through a whole sequence of things with Pilate. For example, Pilate first dealt with him and found out, well, I don't find anything wrong with this man. I don't see why you've got any problem. And they kept crying against him. Then Pilate, while he was sitting on the judgment seat, got a message from his wife, who said, have nothing to do with this just man. She identified him as innocent. She said, for I have suffered many things of him in a dream this day. Pilate was trying to get rid of this problem. So he heard that Herod was there. Now Herod, remember, is the king of the Jews, but his governorship was up in Galilee. So Pilate said, I know what I'll do. I'll send him over to Herod. So he sends him. Jesus goes over to Herod and he stands there. And Herod asked him questions and he wouldn't answer. And Herod tried to communicate. Jesus refused. Now Jesus had answered Pilate and was going to answer him more. Why did he refuse Herod? Herod had no right. Herod had no jurisdiction. He was not under Herod. He was under Pilate. And legally, Pilate had rights over him. But legally, Herod had no rights. He was out of his province. So he refused to answer him. So back to Pilate he goes. Now turn with me to John, the 19th chapter. In the last part of chapter 18, Pilate is discussing with Jesus and ask him, are you a king? And Jesus said, thou sayest. You've got it right, we would say. To this end was I born. But he said, my kingdom is not of this world, verse 36. If it were, then would my servants fight that I should not be delivered unto the Jews. Now Pilate recognized that Jesus was not in competition with Caesar. That his was not a claim for earthly kingship, and yet he had the confusing thing that he claimed to be a king. That's an unusual claim. But he said his kingdom was not of this world. Pilate tried another device. It was the time of the year when traditionally a known convicted criminal was released just out of the mercy of the court. So Pilate called the Jews and he said, look, we've got Jesus and we've got a man who is a known convicted murderer, Barabbas. Whom shall I release? And the crowd said, Barabbas. Release Barabbas. And that's when the famous line came, what shall I do with Jesus? And they said, crucify. In chapter 19 of John, Pilate took Jesus and scourged him. That's a beating, a severe beating. As a matter of fact, history tells us that probably more people died at scourging than made it actually to the cross. And some of the accounts are horrible. The man was taken, usually stripped, hands tied behind his back with a thong or a chain. That passed over his shoulder and often through a hook in the ground or something like that. And then that was pulled to the point that he'd be forced to his knees and the arms up, clearing his back, often breaking the shoulders or dislocating them. And then he was beaten with instruments like a cat of nine tails, with chips of stone or bone or with metal on the ends of it. Sometimes the whip would wrap around the body and puncture holes even in the run, or hit the face, knock out teeth or eyes. Is it any wonder that after Jesus had gone through all of that, he had trouble having the strength to carry the cross? Pilate scourged him, then put on him a purple garment. Now, that was a sign of royalty. And they put a crown that made up of thorns on his head, and he brought him out, and he said, behold the man. And when the chief priests and the officers saw it, they cried out, crucify him, crucify him. Pilate said, you take him and do with him what you will, for I find no crime in him. Pilate still knew that this was an innocent man. But when they heard that, they cried out and said, we have a law, and by that law he ought to die, because he made himself the Son of Man, or the Son of God. And that troubled Pilate. Remember, his wife had had the dreams. Pilate could find nothing wrong. He claimed to be a king, and now they tell him he claims to be the Son of God. That troubled Pilate. And he was the more afraid, and he entered into the praetorium again, and he said to Jesus, where'd you come from? Who are you? What's going on? But Jesus gave him no answer. He had answered him before. Pilate said, therefore, speakest thou not unto me? Knowest thou not that I have power to release thee and power to crucify thee? And Jesus said, you would have no power against me, except it were given thee from above. Therefore, he that delivered me unto thee hath greater sin. Upon this, Pilate sought to release him. But the Jews cried out and said, if you release him, you're no friend of Caesar's, because this man claims to be a king, and we have no king but Caesar's. Can't you see those Jews standing up and saying, we love Caesar? What a lie. And we don't like this guy because he's in competition with Caesar. So they took him, and they crucified him. But as a final stroke, Pilate had an inscription made and placed above his head. And in John 19:19, the inscription was written that said this, Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews. This title, therefore, read many of the Jews. For the place where Jesus was crucified was nigh unto the city. And it was written in Hebrew and in Latin and in Greek. He wanted everybody to read it. And what did it say? Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews. The chief priest of the Jews came to Pilate and said, Pilate, suggestion please. Don't say he is the King of the Jews. Say he says he's the King of the Jews. And Pilate said, What I have written, I have written. I repeat this story. Stories are often not true. I repeat this account to put it in historical perspective. But the point I want us to dwell on today for just a moment, and the application of the lesson today, is this. Pilate did a horrible thing. He's going to be mentioned over in the Acts as one of the four who contributed to the death of Jesus. Judas and Pilate and the Jews and the Romans. He's going to be singled out by God as one of the four in the death picture. But neighbor and friend, if I understand life and if I understand this passage, Pontius Pilate is representative of a lot of us. And I pray that he's not representative of me. And I pray he's not representative of you. Think about it with me for just a moment. Pilate knew Jesus was innocent. Secondly, Pilate wanted to release Jesus. Thirdly, Pilate faced the pressure that he couldn't do what he wanted to do conveniently. And lastly, Pilate made the wrong decision. I wonder how many of us might be pictured, not with the same scenario. We're not governors in Palestine. We don't have people bowing down to us as some kind of supreme ruler or something like that. And we don't have Jesus standing in front of us in flesh and blood today, but figuratively, every one of us has Jesus there. Figuratively, every one of us is going to pass some judgment. I wonder how many of us find ourselves religiously in a parallel situation with Pilate. How many of us today know that Jesus is the Son of God and even know what Jesus wants us to do to be saved? I wonder how many there are in the audience today who've never obeyed the gospel of Jesus Christ and yet who know that that's what they ought to do to be saved. I wonder how many there are in the audience today who perhaps are Christians but are out of duty with the Lord. You've drifted away for one reason or another, or you're doing things that you know down deep alienate you from God. And in your own mind, in your own heart, you're convinced as to what you ought to do to make it right with God. That's the way Pilate was. Pilate knew what was right. Secondly, Pilate wanted to do what was right. And look at the evidence for that. He tried every device that he could come up with, appealing to the Jews, just saying, "I don't find anything wrong with this. Why are you guys so upset?" And they cried out for his death. He offered them Barabbas, and they still cried. He came back again when he had ridiculed him and beat him and scourged him. And he said, "Isn't that enough? Haven't we done enough to this fella?" And they cried out and said, "Any man who is a friend to Jesus is no friend of Caesar's." Pilate wanted to do what was right. Well, Paul describes that kind of situation over in Romans 7. When he talked about the fact that all of us do sin. And he said, "That which I would, that I do not. And that which I would not, that I do. Wretched man that I am, who will deliver me from this bondage of sin?" Now, Romans 7 is showing us that I don't care how righteous you are, you'll still do some things that are wrong. I'm not talking about the fact that it's true that all of us sin and fall short of the glory of God. That's true. But I'm talking about that concept where people know what's right and really want to do what's right, But they don't want it badly enough to pay the price. Because look at the third point. Pilate wanted to do what was right as long as it was convenient to do it. If he could have released Jesus and could have maintained peace to report back to Rome, everything would have been fine. If he could have released Jesus and not had an uprising among the Jews, everything would be fine. But when it came down to the pressure time, that Pilate knew, in order to do what I know is right, I've got to make a sacrifice. I'm going to have to give something up. I'm going to have to take a stand that's unpopular. Pilate didn't do it. How many of us know what we ought to do? And down deep say, oh, I wish I could do that, but my friends are doing this other thing. All my buddies are going to the dance, or all my buddies are out drinking. And if I don't do it, they look at me and they ridicule me, and so I'll just drink a little bit. You know, I really know that, and I wish I didn't. I don't really want to do it. And how many young people have gotten into messes like that? I want to tell you, I know it happens, and you do too. Where the kid says to himself, I really don't want to do this, but that's what the crowd's doing, and I feel pressured to do it. That's exactly the situation Pilate was in. How many of us with a business relationship say to ourselves, I really don't want to use unfair practices. I really want to deal honorably. But if I do, I'm not going to make this deal. Or if I don't do that, my boss won't be pleased. How many of us give in because it's not convenient to serve God? I'm not even going to make an application about something as mundane as staying at home and watching television instead of going to worship God. A lot of times we make points and paint that as a big sacrifice on the part of the Christian's part and a big test in his life as to whether he's going to watch the rest of the Rams. Oops. Let's watch somebody else. We'll have a better chance. Okay. And I can appreciate that because I'm from Tampa Bay. I can understand a losing season. But isn't it kind of ridiculous to have to think in terms of Christians feeling a pressure to make a decision as to whether they're going to go to the services and worship God or watch a little bit of a football game or a soap opera, whether it be a daytime or a nighttime soap? But it's not always convenient to be a Christian. In your job, with your neighbors, in desires of the flesh, it's not always convenient, but it's always right. And it's always best. And Pilate made the wrong decision. And I can see old Pilate now when he called for the bowl of water. And ceremonially, he went through it with them, washed his hands and said, it's no part of man, but it was. You really can't shift those responsibilities. You make your decision. Pilate made his. And it seems that Pilate had had all he could take, and finally he put that sign over his head and said, Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews. They tried to get that down. They said, no, don't say that. Say he says he's king. Pilate said, what I've written, I've written. He'd gone as far as he was going. Unfortunately, he went too far. He made too many compromises. He gave up too much of his own conviction. But finally, he said, I've said that. Now, here's my point for today. I wonder how many of us might be like Pilate. We could put the sign up that says, he is the King of the Jews. But we can't let him really be king in our lives. Are you a Christian? What does the cross of Christ mean to you? He died that we might live. If you've never obeyed the gospel, why don't you do it today? If you're a Christian, but you've been out of duty and you want and need the prayers of others in your behalf, don't be like Pilate. Don't look just for a convenient time. But take a stand for what you know is right. Know the joy and the thrill of saying to God, I believe in Jesus and he means something to me and I appreciate the fact that he died in my behalf. Because if we don't do that, we crucify to ourselves the Son of God afresh and put him to an open shame. If you need publicly to come in response to the gospel, why don't you do it today while we stand and sing?